Thank David for filling in for me last Wednesday, and we, from what I understand, things went well and went through Acts chapter 16, and we are still in Paul's second missionary journey. So we'll be looking at Acts chapter 17 tonight as we talk about conversions in Acts. As just kind of preliminary thought, you've seen as we've talked about the different conversion stories and how the great detail that was happening with the first, you know, conversions and everything that went into baptism and repentance and those kind of things that were being mentioned. David kind of talked about that last Wednesday as well. As we get into these, it just kind of says it happened. It doesn't go into greater detail anymore. Any ideas as to why they might not go into more detail about what it might be for one to be a member of the church at this point in this letter? Any ideas? They know at this point, right? If you're reading a book and you're reading this letter and Luke is recounting what's going on, does he have to tell you now every single time that these are the same things that are happening when they convert? We start seeing things like, you know, a large number of them joined Paul and Silas and that kind of stuff. We don't see a large number of them repented, confessed, and were baptized, repented of their sins. We don't see that kind of language in chapter 17 because we've covered that, ladies and gentlemen. We've gone through that information. So you can't come to this chapter and say, well, they just believed, right? No, it doesn't even say that on some of these things. So let's just be aware of that. We're not covering new ground in that area. But we're looking at, as far as the conversions in chapter 17, things are kind of escalating again for Paul and Silas. And Luke is no longer with them as we think about them traveling. There's a separation there between chapter 16 and 17 where it's we, and then 17 is they. And he's writing about what they did, and so he is not including himself in chapter 17. So chapter 17 opens up, and we're traveling. We're on the road again. And it mentions a couple cities that they go to, and they travel through these cities, travel through Amphilus and Apollonia, and they came to Thessalonica. Now, why did they just bypass these cities? We don't know, and we don't know what they did while they were in these cities. But when they came to Thessalonica, what does it say Paul's custom was in verse 2? What was Paul's custom? They went into the synagogue, right? He went to the synagogue. This is Paul's bread and butter move. When I played football many, many years ago, our coach said, all right, this is our bread and butter move. This, if we can execute this consistently every time, and we can just move the ball 3 yards, right, then we can do this. So this is Paul's bread and butter move. We're going to go to the synagogue. That's what we do every single time. And so we see that here with this custom that he does this. Now, just so you know, when they're traveling from these places, just the distances between where they were and traveling from Philippi, we're talking about a little over 60 miles traveling from this place now to Thessalonica. And I don't know when the last time you guys walked 60 miles, but it's been a while for me. So I think in a month, how many of you guys do Fitbit? That's off topic anyway, but you understand, like, I don't think you're tracking that many miles. So they get here, and according to Paul's custom, they go and go to the Sabbath, or go to the synagogue and teach on the Sabbath. Now, for them to be a synagogue at this place, that means there's a large Jewish population, right? You don't have like 10, 15 Jewish families and have a synagogue necessarily. You have a large Jewish population to support and sustain this synagogue. And so there is a large synagogue. Now, his custom was they went to the synagogue, and for three Sabbaths, what does it say? What does the text say he did with him specifically? He reasoned with them from the Scriptures. He went in and was just a good example. And Paul, he's the best Jew I've ever seen, right? He reasoned with them from the Scriptures. Concerning the things, right? And so in verse 3, explaining and giving evidence that Christ had to suffer. So this was his custom to go into this place, and he was explaining and giving evidence. What evidence do you think he might have been giving them at this time. What evidences? Oh, yes, very much so. It would have gone to the prophets and the fulfillment of prophecies that Christ fulfilled, and we see that even in the writing of the letter of the Hebrews, and they use that quite a bit. It's something that they did while they were there. So that was something, evidences that he was explaining and giving evidence. Look over in 1 Thessalonians. There's some things, some telltale signs here in 1 Thessalonians. Chapter 1, verse 5. Some of you with your notebooks are like, you can't just tell me the book. You got to give me chapter and verse so I can actually turn over there. So that's what I do with the teenagers, because I don't want them to get ahead of me. I just tell them the book, and then I turn over there, and then I give them the chapter and verse, because they're just waiting with their cell phones, if they're paying attention. But anyway, 1 Thessalonians 1, 5. For our gospel did not come to you in word only, but also in power, and in the Holy Spirit, with full conviction, just as you know what kind of men we prove to be among you for your sake. So how does Paul say, and he's writing this letter to the church in Thessalonica, we're looking at the events, you know, as they unfold there, and now he's writing back to them later on, and how does he say, what evidence does he give here? He said, not in word only, but what else? The Holy Spirit. But in power and in the Holy Spirit, and we quasi-believed what we were talking about. What does it say? Conviction. There was conviction. They believed what they're talking about. So if somebody's talking to you and they have evidence, but they don't really believe, how many of you have tried to be upsold on something, but you can really tell they don't believe what they're trying to sell you? Has that ever happened to you? And so here, there was conviction in what they were saying and what they were talking. So he talks to them, they were explaining, giving evidence that Christ had to suffer. Now, the reason why this is maybe mentioned here is because that Christ had to suffer. Not that he did suffer, but that he had to suffer. Is different because their concept of who this king, this Messiah was going to be, is an earthly king that would not suffer. King, how many kings do you know that suffer on purpose? Not many, right? I mean, you guys don't really know kings anyway, but you get the idea, right? People who are ruling authorities, they usually don't suffer. They're the ones the last to suffer. And so he's saying here, he's teaching them, he had to suffer. Now, when you read Isaiah 53, as that is fulfillment of prophecy, he had to suffer to fulfill that prophecy. He was not the kind of king that they supposed he would be. And so one of their arguments against, well, this illegitimate child from Nazareth, he could not have been the Messiah because he was born in poverty and he was not the king. He wasn't a kingly figure. But Paul is telling him he had to suffer. That was not the image that was accurate concerning him. And so we see here they taught with conviction. And in chapter 2, verse 9 as well, for you recall, brethren, our labor and hardship, how working night and day so as not to be a burden to any of you, we proclaim to you the gospel of God. And so it wasn't that they were just working and that they were just teaching, but they were laboring night and day to not be a burden to them. They weren't asking any kind of funds from them. When he writes to the church in Philippi, he talks about how they supplied to his needs. So the church in Philippi supplied to his needs so he could preach and work in Thessalonica as loyal as laboring and what they could do to not be a burden upon them. And so we see that kind of atmosphere that he's laboring here in Thessalonica. And so he's teaching them that he had to suffer and rise again from the dead, saying, this Jesus whom I am proclaiming to you is the Christ. Does that sound familiar? Does that sound like an Acts 2 statement almost? This Jesus whom you crucified, right? So again, we're going back. It is so the imperative here on actually knowing who the Christ is the beginning place. When we're teaching and working with people, the main concept we have to get across is, who is this Jesus that you talk about every day. Sorry, I didn't mean to go into song, but do you understand that we have to start there? And so when he's going here, he's teaching them who this is, who the Christ is, that he had to suffer, and that he was, that he raised from the dead. So this is who we're talking about. And what was the outcome? Verse 4. How did they respond? It's kind of a mixed bag, right? So some of them were persuaded. And we look in verse 4, there's kind of a delineation between these two groups. What kind of groups are we talking about here? What distinction is made between some and then another group of many, or a large number of many? Some Jews. It doesn't technically say Jews, does it? But we kind of get from the delineation here that some of the Jews and a great many of the Greeks, but a great many of what kind of Greeks? God-fearing Greeks. So these were some that were kind of, the well was already primed. They understood some of what Paul was talking about. Having been maybe proselytes and those kind of things, fearing God. We've seen that in other places in Acts already, of those who are Greeks that understood and bought into the concept that there was one God. There wasn't a plurality of gods. And so we're going to see that kind of very strange in connection with another place we're going tonight. But we look here, we see these God-fearing Greeks and a number of the leading women. So we see the response. And a good thing happens in verse 4, right? A good thing happens. But what happens in verse 5? But the Jews, right? It's like a wash, rinse, repeat. We keep going through this cycle in that, but the Jews becoming jealous. It wasn't for the cause of truth. It wasn't because it was right or wrong. It wasn't because Paul burned down their climbing tree, right? It was because they were jealous of what was going on, right? There was the reason that they were beginning to attack Paul and Silas and those laboring with him is out of jealousy. Out of jealousy. It's not a new chapter, that kind of happened with Christ as well, right? And so we see this happening. Now they take a play, and they want to turn things. They're in a situation where they're in a Greco-Roman society, and in order to kind of get everybody against them, they take a play and spin some information so that they can kind of make Paul and Silas the bad guys. And so what do they do here? Is it becoming jealous? Taking along some wicked men, which there's always some wicked men laying around, right? There's always some wicked men that are laying around that'll do whatever you want them to do. And so here they take some wicked men from the marketplace, formed a mob, and set the city in an uproar, which means that the city was not in an uproar. Right? Everything was cool, calm, and copacetic. Like everybody was fine playing in their sandbox, doing what they're supposed to do, right? And then the Jews said, let's do this. There wasn't an issue until we had people come in and make it an issue. And they set the city in uproar. And so why do you think they're trying to track down the house of Jason? What do you think was happening at Jason's house? Do you think maybe they were worshiping at Jason's house? Do you think maybe that's kind of where the church was kind of meeting, in Jason's home? And so here they're trying to track down the house of Jason. They're speaking to bring him out to the people. They did not find Paul and Silas, right? They didn't find them, but they dragged Jason out. Now here's Jason. You're Jason, right? You've not been a Christian but 10 minutes. Not really, obviously, it's been a little bit longer than that, but you've not been a Christian very long. And all of a sudden, based on your convictions, people are dragging you out of your home because of your convictions. Did he change? Did he do anything different? We don't see that he faltered in his conviction here. And they dragged Jason, some of the brethren, before the city authorities, shouting, "These men who have upset the world have come here also." Now, had they really upset the world? Really? Now, it's possible that many people have heard about what was going on. But do you think to get the city authorities on their side, they might have exaggerated a little bit? I don't doubt that people knew about this Christ. I don't doubt at all that people knew about what was going on and had heard about what was going on. So, for them to make that accusation, these authorities had to have heard about what was happening, at least. And so these have set the world, have come here also. And so they make this accusation. And what do they say about Jason, verse 7? These guys, these troublemakers have come here, and what do they accuse Jason of? Jason welcomed them in, right? Jason made that happen. And they all act contrary to the decrees of Caesar, saying there is another king, Jesus. Is it pretty obvious what they're trying to do? They're trying to use some rules, spin some truth, spin some lies rather, twist the truth, and to make it look like they're doing something they're not doing. Now, had they ever taught that Jesus Christ is King of Kings and Lord of Lords? Yes. Paul himself writes that in his letter to Timothy. It was something that was taught. It was something that was regularly understood about who Christ was. But were they teaching in a physical kingdom concept? No. Were they trying to overthrow any kind of authorities? No. Remember, they were playing in their sandbox, minding their own business. Everything was fine until the Jews came along and stirred up this controversy. So it was those Jews that stirred up this controversy. And so we see here we have conversions in the church in Thessalonica, and it did not start easy. It wasn't easy. But did it stop? It didn't stop. It continued. It wasn't easy, but it continued. And what's interesting here is that we see the brethren begin to take initiative here. So they stirred up the crowd and the city authorities who feared these things. Because what we know later on in chapter 19, or chapter 18 rather, that the Jews had been kicked out of Rome. So you don't want to upset kind of an uneasy situation. And so those authorities who were in charge of this place, who were in charge of keeping the peace and making sure everything's good, they're going to do everything they can to make sure Rome hasn't have to come down there and take care of things. Because if Rome comes down and takes care of things, then those authorities, it's not good for them, right? It's not good for them. So they have that kind of pressure from that side, and the Jews know this, and they're stirring things up. When they heard, they received, so they make this charge. And in verse 9, when they received a pledge or a bond, maybe a penalty from Jason and the others, they released them. That is how the church starts in Thessalonica. Again, we have people starting and people being converted in difficult circumstances, but they continue on anyway. Verse 10 is kind of what I was talking about. The brethren immediately sent Paul and Silas away. So it was the brethren take initiative. Why do you think they took the initiative to make sure Paul and Silas went away from this scenario? What's that?
Probably coming after them next.
Yes, so they know they're coming after Paul and Silas, but we see concern on behalf of those in Thessalonica, a concern for Paul and those that are working with them. We see that they're taking initiative. You don't need to be here. We'll stay here. You don't need to be here. And so they are sent away. Paul and Silas are sent away by night, and they go down to Berea. And when they arrived in Berea, they totally changed their playbook and did something different. What does it say? They marched right into the synagogue, right? They knew, right? Every time they go to this place, they go to another city, they go in and they know the possibility. The possibility is always there that it's not going to be great doing this, right? And so I don't know if like Paul and Silas look at each other like, here we go again, right, kind of thing. And Paul's like, well, you're not the one that got stoned. So that, you know, they kind of go in to the synagogue with that. But we see this conviction. We're going to do this no matter what's going on. We're going to keep doing this. Because, again, conviction and the urgency that's there to make sure they know these things. And so now these were more noble-minded. Why were these more noble-minded according to the text? What does the text say about them? They searched the scriptures, right? So these were more noble-minded than those in Thessalonica, for they received the word with great eagerness, examining the scriptures daily to see whether these things were so. We're just going to take it, oh yeah, yeah, you can do miracles, blah, blah, blah. We're not going to take it at face value until we've compared it to the word. Okay, we compared it to the scriptures. So we see, again, a heart kind of scenario here that's called out that we don't see in other places. Those in Berea are those that the scriptures are important to them. And once you've shown and once you've connected the dots for them, things fall into place. They can't get enough. Have you ever seen anybody, or maybe you yourself have been in a situation where you're learning something new, and once, like all, I remember math in sixth grade was a challenge for me. Math has been a challenge for me all my life. I'm going to be honest, just going to be soft underbelly kind of scenario here, but math has been a challenge for me. But I remember in sixth grade, there was one teacher that I don't know what she did. She just explained it in such a way that all the little tumblers fell into place and it clicked. And I got it. And oh man, I understand why there's letters now. Like I can do this, right? And you go on. And so here we see that kind of eagerness to learn now. Now you've put all those things in place and now that things are coming together, there's great eagerness to learn. There's conviction there. I can explain this to somebody else now. I can teach somebody else how to do math with letters in it. So now we can go on, and we see that conviction here with this eagerness. Therefore, many of them believed among the number of the prominent Greek women and men. Good things happened, right? What happens in verse 13? But the Jews from Thessalonica. Guys, this just from Thessalonica down to where we are now is 60 miles. 60 plus miles. They walked 60 miles just to be stinkers in another city. Now, Paul can't really say much because he did the same thing, right? He can't really say much. He did, you know, being a man of conviction, he did some similar things. But the text tells us it wasn't for religious conviction that they were doing this. What does the text tell us they were doing this? Why were they doing this? Because of jealousy. Because of jealousy they were doing this. Personally, I would have let him go at that point. It's not in my city anymore, right? But they went. So, but the Jews of Thessalonica found out that the word of God had been proclaimed by Paul and Berea, and they came there as well, agitating and stirring up the crowds. And immediately, brethren, Paul sent Paul out as far as the sea, and Silas and Timothy remained there. So Paul was kind of seen as a main instigator. He was the one that was kind of like all the jealousy and all the angst was upon him. So Silas and Timothy were able to stay there, and Paul goes. So now those who escorted Paul brought him as far as Athens. And so again, we're going to take you a long ways away and make sure that... yes, ma'am.
I just have a question. Teaching, that's what that was about?
Yes, so they did not believe that Jesus was a Christ. And it sounds like some of the hearts of those, no matter what information you gave them, they weren't going to accept it. Right, so he's going into great detail, trying to explain and help them understand with the Holy Spirit and everything. This is actually the Christ. But the text tells us that it was jealousy. So here they're working in this city. Let's say you go into a city and you're working there, and you know you're trying to build a customer base at your bakery or whatever. And then the new bakery across the street comes in, and everybody flocks to that bakery, and everybody goes there. And what you're sitting there, and you're selling your day-old stuff because nobody's coming in and buying it anymore. Do you understand? Like, so jealousy. Everybody, they're leaving the synagogue. They're no longer in the synagogue. I'm no longer a prominent figure. I'm no longer the one that everybody turns to. And so jealousy is what we're seeing there. And then maybe there are those who... are kind of religious convicted, you know, people that are, but are really the main motivation for what we're reading in the text is jealousy is what. And so they continue to chase Paul down in what they're doing. It's a very, very sad scenario that they didn't themselves obviously make the right choices. And so Paul goes down to Athens. Now we look in, and I'm not even progressing. I'm getting all excited here. I'm not even doing the slides. Okay, so he left and went to Athens. Were you doing the slides for me? I appreciate that. I was getting all excited. He goes to Athens, and he's waiting there. So Timothy and Silas are there in Berea. He's waiting in Athens, and he's looking around at a city full of idols. So here's a man who teaches the truth that there is one God, right? And that Jesus Christ is the son of that God, and that and now he's in this city that is 100%, you know, could not be more opposite to what Paul teaches, what the truth of things. You know, my mind goes back to, like, just Lot being vexed daily, as we talk about Lot being in Sodom, as far as that, the disparity between what the truth and how the people are acting in an area. And so Paul's there, and what does it say was happening to his spirit while he was there in verse 16? He was getting stirred up, right? This isn't right. So I don't know if you guys know. I don't think we need to go into a Martin story. No, we won't go into that. But there are missionaries that get really stirred up and fired up. Robert Martin's one of those. And brother, like he starts telling you a story, and you can tell when he gets stirred up. And Paul is stirred up, and he's in this city full of idols. So he's reasoning in the synagogue. He's doing his thing in chapter 17, reasoning with the Jews in the synagogue and God-fearing Gentiles. So wash, rinse, repeat, wash, rinse, repeat. We're doing the same thing. It works. We go to those who have a base, who understand the scriptures, and then we go to those that we can begin teaching. And so the God-fearing Gentiles in the marketplace every day with those who happen to be present. He's going in the marketplace and teaching, and if you happen to be there to hear it, that's great. But he's going to be there every day teaching the gospel. And so he's there. And also some of the Epicurean and Stoic philosophers were conversing with him. Paul's an educated man, and when he's talking with these philosophers, he's able to reason with them. What's interesting is, for Epicureans, their biggest thing was the enjoyment of life. The best thing of life is pleasure through modest, sustainable pleasure. Right? There are various thought processes even amongst Epicureans, but that's the main idea, that life is enjoyed through pleasure. And the Stoics are those who are not controlled by pleasure or fear, but understanding one's role in nature and kind of fitting in with the world around you and, making sure that you're doing what's right in your surroundings. And so those are the two schools of thought that we're dealing with here with these philosophers and their thinking. And so these are things that have been thought about since around 300 BC is kind of when the roots of these things. So hundreds of years have taken place before we're in this place now, when they're still talking and been thinking about these things, entrenched in this concept. And so that's why they're here. And what do they ask him? Some were saying what? They were curious. And there were two schools of thought here concerning Paul, right? In verse 18. What would this idle babbler wish to say? What are they doing with Paul and his message when they speak to him that way? He doesn't know what he's talking about. He's not like us. We've been thinking about things for a long time. We were thinking about things before your grandfather was thinking about things, right? So their concept of the world was very different. But others, it says he seems to be a proclaimer of strange deities. And so because he was preaching Jesus and the resurrection. So they took him up and brought him up to Areopagus. And this was an area, it's kind of a hill. This is an area where a court was held. And this is an area where they would have formal meetings, the Areopagites, and talk and discuss things. This may not have been necessarily a formal meeting, but he was there, and he was up there. And They ask him, "We may know what this new teaching is, which you are proclaiming. For you're bringing something strange, some strange things to our ears, so we want to know what these things mean." Now, if you ever get that opportunity, always say yes. Always, always take the opportunity. When somebody opens a door, that sounds strange. I've never really heard about it that way, or I've never heard it explained that way. Would you mind explaining it? Always say yes. Maybe not when if it's your barber and they're cutting your hair at the moment. I have done that, and it didn't turn out so well. But my dad always says the difference between a good haircut and a bad haircut is about 2 weeks, right? So, for guys anyway. Anyway, in this situation, he gets this invitation to go up and to teach. It happens from time to time. This still happens. I mean, obviously not in that place, but when I was on Easter Island, the Assemblies of God said, we've never heard, we'd like to actually have you come teach. Would you mind teaching our Wednesday Bible study? Yes, I would. I would love to teach your Wednesday Bible study. It wasn't formal worship, it wasn't high or anything like that. It was just a few of us sitting around in chairs studying the Bible. But when you get the invitation, go. Go. He got the invitation, so he went. Now, when he goes to this place, you got to kind of start. He can't jump off with Abraham, right? Can he do that? Can he just jump off with Abraham? You can't do that because they have no idea who you're talking about. And so he begins. So Paul stood in the midst of the Areopagus and said, "Men of Athens, I observe that you are very religious in all respects." And what does he base that upon? All these idols and everything that are and things that are around. So there were some who joked in that time period that it was easier to find a god in Athens than a man, because there were so many places of oblation all around the city. Some have said there was 30,000 gods in Athens, and so there were all these places there. And so in this situation, he starts at a place where he can kind of have an in with them and their thought process to the unknown God. Now, they can't stop him and say, "Well, we don't want to hear about this unknown God." Why can't they stop him? You have an altar to an unknown God, right? You don't know who he is. Well, let me explain. They can't not let him explain that. So there's that invitation. There's that open place. And so he begins explaining to them, right? "I also found an altar with this inscription to an unknown God. Therefore, what you worship in ignorance, this I proclaim to you." That's his opening. This is where we're going to go with this. And David, I actually don't remember how much time I have or where we're stopping. In 10 minutes? Oh, great. We're good. Okay. So here is this opening that he begins. So God, the Creator, is where he starts. Now, if you're the Stoic, you're going to want to know about, they're talking about something new. I'm not progressing this. Okay, here we go. I'll get on top of this in a second. To the unknown God. God, the Creator. Now, we talked about the Stoic needs to know about things about creation, because they kind of want to operate inside that concept and construct of what's created. And so he begins to talk about the God who made the world and all the things in it. "Since he is Lord of heaven and earth, does not dwell in temples made with hands." So what is he saying to them? He's a God of all things. You have a plurality of gods. A God for, just pick anything. Right? They literally had a God for everything. Right? And so here he's saying, this is a God of all things, that created all things. That's like, you can't get any higher than that, right? You can't go above that. And so here's a God that created all things, that made the world and all things in it, since he is Lord of heaven and earth and does not dwell in temple made with hands. What you can't see in your, and maybe you can, but he could literally point to temples all around him. On the Areopagus, he's standing there, and above him, higher than where they are right now, is this huge temple. He could point to that temple and say he does not dwell in temples made with hands. You see where he's going with this? And so this is pretty cool. So he's pointing to these places. He's telling them what's going on. Nor is he served by human hands. What have they been doing all their lives? Taking offerings and serving these things by human hands. These idols, these statues, these temples, these gods. So again, he's creating this line of demarcation between the God of the universe and what you think is true. Your concept of truth. He's boring a hole into their worldview. But he started at the opening that they left for him. To the unknown God. And he begins teaching again, continuing this. And so, nor is he served with human hands, as though he needed anything, since he himself gives to all people life, breath, and all things. And he made from one man every nation, mankind, to live on the face of the earth, having determined their appointed times and the boundaries of their habitation, that they would seek God. Look over in 1 Corinthians chapter 1. This was a theme that, you know, they had to deal with in that world a lot. 1 Corinthians chapter 1, verse 21. For since the wisdom of God, the world through its wisdom did not come to know God, God was well pleased through the foolishness of the message preached to save those. So what is Paul writing here? What is he saying about the world? Did the world know who God was? They did not know who he was. They did not understand everything that was going on. Look back in Acts chapter 14. Acts 14, verses 16 and 17. In the generations gone by, he permitted all the nations to go their own ways. And yet he did not leave himself without witness. And he did good and gave you rains from heaven and fruitful seasons, satisfying your hearts with food and gladness. He allowed men to go the way they wanted to go. But he knew there was a day coming when Paul would be preaching in this place, when the message would be proclaimed. And we see that here. And Paul's saying this. He's giving you life and breath in all things. This is also mentioned and talked about those who would seek after God, if perhaps they might grope for him and find him, though he is not far from each one of us. For in him we live and move and exist, as even some of your own poets have said, for we are also his children. Look over in Romans chapter 1, beginning of verse 18. For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and righteousness of men who suppress the truth in unrighteousness, because that which is known about God is evident within them, for God made it evident to them. For since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes, his eternal power and divine nature have been clearly seen, being understood through that which has been made. So they are without excuse. Nature proclaims the grandeur of God. Nature proclaims that. He left people to their own devices, but he did not leave them without a witness of who he was. And so nature is that. And so, for even though they knew God, they did not honor him as God or give thanks, but they became futile in their speculations, and their foolish heart was darkened. Professing to be wise, they became fools and exchanged the glory of the incorruptible God for an image, form of corruptible man, and the birds and four-footed animals and crawling creatures. And we could not have picked a place or been to a place where they thought themselves to be more wise than this place here in Athens. But in God's sight, they were fools. They had no idea what was going on. Just because you think you know doesn't mean you know, right? We've all been guilty of that, where you thought you knew something, and it turns out you didn't. And in this case, they don't know. So what they proclaimed to the unknown God that they didn't know, they didn't know how much they didn't know. Does that make sense? They did not grasp what was going on. And so, verse 29, being then children of God, we ought not think of the divine nature as like gold or silver or stone. And so it begins teaching them what's going on, how we need to respond. So here is who God is. Here is this unknown God. Here's what he's done. And here's how we need to respond to him. Because why? Because he has fixed a day in which he will judge the world in righteousness through a man whom he has appointed, having furnished proof to all men by raising him from the dead. And so God is the creator, God is the sustainer, and God is the judge. The day is coming. He has fixed a day. It's one thing to say he has a day. It's another thing to say he has fixed a day. What's the difference there? It's determined. How many times have parents, have you said, well, when your dad gets home, this is going to happen, right? You know, and dad gets home and it doesn't necessarily happen, and then all of a sudden, like, you're that kid that, like, dad's home now and I'm not getting in trouble yet. So, you know, the things kind of slide. But God has fixed a day. It's not sliding. It's not going anywhere. It is fixed. We don't know. We don't know what it is. It is fixed. It's going to happen. And this man, who he raised from the dead, proving who he was, is what needs. This man through whom he has appointed, having furnished proof by raising from the dead. Now, when they heard these things, how do they respond to this concept of the resurrection? Yeah, some heard this resurrection of the dead and began to sneer. Others said, "We shall hear more of you again concerning this." And so Paul went out of their midst. So you have kind of three responses here. You have those who obviously mock it because they are set in how they think. I'm sure you've talked to people like that who, it doesn't matter what you say, how many times you say it, how many angles you come at it, they are set in how they think. Then there are those who might say, maybe I'll hear it. They'll be nice and say, I'll hear it about it again some other time. But what was the third group here? But some men joined him and believed. We don't see that with the other two, right? We don't see that with the other two. But some men joined him and believed, among whom also were Dionysus, the Areopagite, and a woman named Damaris, and others with them. These two are named here, and we never hear about them again. But they are named in the Bible for their faith coming out of that situation. Here is one of the Areopagites, one of the ones who would sit and judge, one of the ones who was a prominent figure. His heart was changed because of the information. Another conversion. It was difficult. It wasn't the way it always goes. And from city to city, it's not the same. It doesn't always happen the same. But the message is the same. Our plan of attack can be the same. Our conviction can be the same. But how it plays out, only God knows how it's going to play out. But it doesn't change what I have to do. It doesn't change my responsibility. And it didn't change his. Even though he's gotten rocks thrown at his head for doing it in other places, right? He continues doing this kind of thing. Any thoughts or questions, comments? Was that the second bell? Okay, good. All right, well, we see here again this pride in those that kept them from doing what they're supposed to do, but we saw humility in those that made that decision to change. And that's, again, what it came down to for these. Next week, we'll, I believe, is our last class next week, or do we have two more? I think we have two more. Excellent. Thank you very much for your time, and we'll see you next week.